Every year, it's my pleasure and my honor to invoke the spirit of Larry Levis, who, after all, is the person for whom this event constitutes a living memorial. By honoring the poets who win the prize, we carry on his memory, a person who was such an inventive and creative poet. One of the things that happened when Larry Levis came to VCU is that he took over a writing workshop that had previously been taught by the esteemed poet Dave Smith. And Dave had set up certain habitual practices in that workshop, which those students attempted to carry on when Larry came into it. One of them was that when he walked into the workshop and the workshop began, one of the students would begin the workshop by reiterating what the poem was about and basically kind of narrating the story of the poem. They often would talk about it as though there was very little distinction between the poet's biography and the poet's poem. They would speak of them as if they were the same thing. When Larry heard this one evening, after several evenings of witnessing this habit that these students had, he blew up at them and just stopped the whole class in the middle of it and said, "I don't give a damn about your petty little life." And he walked out. He walked out of the class. Now, there are two interpretations that you could attach to this story. One is that Larry was teaching them an extremely valuable lesson that even poetry rooted in autobiography is nevertheless not to be, like journalism, a slave of memory, but instead is to be a witness of the imagination. However, the truth is that it's entirely possible that he just really needed a cigarette. The theme tonight is identity, your life story and how it fits with art. On another occasion, Larry and I were both present at a faculty meeting when one of the faculty members there was complaining about the nature of student evaluations and how unfair they were, how unfair they could be, particularly with regard to the difference between how easy it was for creative writing faculty members to get a good evaluation and how difficult it was for teachers of literature, of real literature, to achieve high evaluations. And in my experience, one is just as hard as the other, and I'm not in any way attempting to cast aspersions on my colleagues who teach literature. It is one of the most difficult jobs there is. But teaching creative writing is also. And at that meeting, a faculty member pointed at me and said, "Well, of course, here comes Donovan in his blue jeans and his boots and with all of his touchy-feely way of dealing with the students. And of course they give him high evaluations for his teaching, but the rest of us have to teach really difficult and challenging things that people don't want to do." And she particularly got excited about this idea of me wearing boots. That seemed to be particularly offensive. Larry waited a little while, as he was in the habit of doing, and then as he also was in the habit of doing, because he was kind of double-jointed, he twisted his arms up, and the more he twisted his arms up, the more you knew something was coming. And he said, "Well, you know, I think actually it's possible that the teaching of literature and the teaching of creative writing are both difficult undertakings." And then he pulled his leg out from underneath the table, and he is tall, and he had a very long leg. And he stuck it up on the table, and he said, "Oh, and I wear boots too." And he had a big black cowboy boot on. Well, of course I loved him dearly for that, and that's part of the reason why I repeat the story. But later on, there was more to it that was even more fun, because we went back up to the offices that he and I shared, and we were both then, as now, forbidden to smoke cigarettes by our various doctors. And so, of course, he went into the drawer in his office in the desk drawer and pulled out the forbidden pack. And he said, "You want a cigarette, man?" I said, "Yeah, I really could use a cigarette after that meeting. That was really something." And he said, "Yeah, I know, that was really something. Said, okay, let's have a cigarette." So we had a cigarette together, and we smoked a cigarette, and we're standing there smoking a cigarette. And for a moment, he looked at me with a long, dramatic pause, and his eyebrows went up, as they sometimes did, and he got the evil gleam in his eye. He turned his cigarette backwards. He started puffing it this way. And he looked at me, he looked at my boots, he looked at his boots, and he said, and if you know the treasure of the Sierra Madre, you know this scene. He said, "Badges? We don't need no stinking badges." The next story I'd like to tell, I unfortunately can't recall exactly Larry's side of the story, so I'm just going to tell you my side of the story. We often would eat dinner together and share stories from the past, and because we were of a certain age, we both had been long hairs at a certain time in our life when that was not a popular thing to be, when it was kind of a dangerous thing to be, as a matter of fact. We sometimes would tell each other stories about things that had happened to us with the police involving our long hair. One night he told me the story of how he had gotten thrown out of a town. He had been told to leave town and never come back. So that solicited from me my own story about that, which I'll tell you very briefly. One day I was actually brought into the move of a friend of mine because, as often happened in those days, I would get brought in on various people's moves because I was the proud owner of a Volkswagen van. I was helping a friend in St. Louis move a big pile of furniture. And of course, because I was a long hair and he was a long hair, the police pulled us over because they thought all the furniture was stolen. I spoke to the officer with extreme politeness, as I was in the habit of doing in those days, because otherwise you might get a billy club upside the head. He took my license and he looked at me and he shined a flashlight into the car and he looked at all the furniture and he said, "Where'd you get this stuff?" I said, "It's his." He said, "Right." I said, "No, it's his furniture and I'm helping him move." He said, "Sure." He said, "Here's what I want from you. I want you to get out of town by sundown, and I don't want to ever see you in this town again." Now, near as I could tell, he was talking about the city of St. Louis. And I actually did dare to say to him, "This is my hometown. I can't get out of town." But after a moment, I realized that that was very unwise, and so I said, "Okay, officer, I will. I'll be out of town by sundown, I promise." Because what else could you say? Larry was, like me, familiar with being thrown out of town for who you were. Or maybe it really wasn't who you were. It's just who someone thought you were. And there always is a difference between the story of your life as you might imagine it, and the story as others might see it, and the story as you might present it in fiction or in poetry. The interchange between all of those things is a life. It's a life in the art of writing. Larry was particularly inventive in how he made use of autobiographical materials. Other people have been able to do that as well, notably drawing on their own stories to make new stories, or taking a particular attitude about their own lives, about how they felt about whether or not they wanted to defend their lives. Just for a moment, I'll give you a sample of somebody who had that attitude. This is Larry Levis' poem, "My Story in a Late Style of Fire." Whenever I listen to Billie Holiday, I am reminded that I too was once banished from New York City. Not because of drugs or because I was interesting enough for any wan, overworked patrolman to worry about. His expression, usually a great gauzy spider web of bewilderment over his face. I was banished from New York City by a woman. Sometimes, after we had stopped laughing, I would look at her and see a cold note of sorrow or puzzlement go over her face, as if someone else were there, behind it, not laughing at all. We were, I think, in love. No, I'm sure. If my house burned down tomorrow morning, and if I and my wife and son stood looking on at the flames, and if then someone stepped out of the crowd of bystanders and said to me, "Didn't you once know?" No. But if one of the flames, rising up in a scherzo of fire, turned all the windows blank with light, and if that flame could speak, and if it said to me, "You loved her, didn't you?" I'd answer, hands in my pockets, "Yes." And then I'd let fire and misfortune overwhelm my life. Sometimes, remembering those days, I watch a warm, dry wind bothering a whole line of elms and maples along a street in this neighborhood until they're all moving at once, until I feel just like them, trembling and in unison. None of this matters now. But I never felt alone all that year. And if I had sorrows, I also had laughter, the affliction of angels and children, which can set a whole house on fire if you'd let it. And even then you might still laugh to see all of your belongings set you free in one long choiring of flames that sang only to you, either because no one else could hear them or because no one else wanted to. And mostly because they know. They know such music cannot last, and that it would tear them apart if they listened. In those days, I was in fact already married, just as I am now, although to another woman. And that day, I could have stayed in New York. I had friends there. I could have strayed up Lexington Avenue or down to Third and caught a faint glistening of the sea between the buildings. But all I wanted was to hold her all morning until her body was again a bright field, or until we both reached some thicket as if at the end of a lane or at the end of all desire, and where we could, therefore, be alone again and make some dignity out of loneliness, as mostly people cannot do. Billie Holiday, whose life was shorter and more humiliating than my own, would have understood all this, if only because, even in her late addiction and her blood stream's hallelujahs, she too sang often of some affair or someone gone and therefore permanent. And sometimes she sang for nothing, even then, and it isn't anyone's business if she did. That morning, when she asked me to leave, wearing only the apricot-tinted fraying chemise, I wanted to stay, but I also wanted to go, to lose her suddenly, almost for no reason, and certainly without any explanation. I remember looking down at a pair of singular tracks made in a light snow the night before, at how they were gradually effacing themselves beneath the tires of the morning traffic, and thinking that my only other choice was fire, ashes, abandonment, solitude, all of which happened anyway, and soon after, and by divorce. I know this isn't much, but I wanted to explain this life to you, even if I had to become, over the years, someone else to do it. You have to think of me what you think of me. I had to live my life, even its late florid style. Before you judge this, think of her. Then think of fire, its laughter, the music of splintering beams and glass, the flames reaching through the second story of a house, almost as if to mistakenly rescue someone who left you years ago. It is so American, fire. So like us, its desolation and its eventual brief triumph.